Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the first podcast of July 2018. And by the way, this is brought to you by Pod by 8 Sleep, and I'll tell you about that a little bit more. As somebody who takes his sleep very seriously, I'm kind of jazzed about this. Our guest today is former Congressman Dave Jolly, who is, I think this is your third appearance on the Bulwark Podcast, isn't it, David?
Second or third, but I enjoy listening to it more than I enjoy being on it, because you got a great podcast going, Charlie. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so it's just another, you know, Monday, normal Monday in Trump land. You know, here's part of the problem of Mondays these days. I'm going back over the things that happened the weekend and stuff that would have been world-changing stories because they were 2 days ago. You kind of forget them. You know, the president gushing over Vladimir Putin, you know, praising MBS despite murdering a journalist, the sucking up to one dictatorial thug after another. And it's sort of like, yeah, that's just sort of Trump. It's G20. But hey, we got this great TV moment where Donald Trump walks over to North Korea and shakes Kim Jong-un's hand. So peace in our time. Nobel Peace Prize, right? What's not to like?
That's right. That's right. You know, and the president tries to position himself as a deal maker, and he tries to suggest that being a disruptor allows him to be a deal maker. And that's how he would frame what happened in North Korea. But the reality is he continues to elevate the dictator of North Korea and elevate him in a way that nobody on the world stage would suggest is the right approach. There is no strategy here, Charlie. We know that. It is a TV moment. The president lives for these TV moments. But if you look back at some of these moments where a U.S. president has confronted or even tried to deal with an adversary or a foe, the American people understand the strategy behind it. There is none in this moment. It is just Trump and North Korea, and the president is soaking in the limelight, thinking that he is contributing to geopolitical stability when really he is disrupting stability.
Well, this is one of those many, many moments where I think, you know, I am old enough to remember when Republican presidents wouldn't engage in this kind of appeasement, or when the conservative base would have been absolutely outraged at this kind of kowtowing, almost literal kowtowing to some of the worst people in the world. And there's a series of tweets out there from mainly your Fox News folks, some of the Trumpist media, you know, ripping Barack Obama for being willing to talk with dictators. And it's not hard to imagine what their reaction would have been if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or John Kerry would have done or said one-tenth of what happened just this weekend.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it's interesting. I've tried to come up with historical analogies here, because the reality is any political party, when we assign party loyalty to a certain foreign policy approach, sometimes it's the wrong lens through which to view it, because times change and foreign policy is not always a partisan lens. It has to absorb all of the geopolitical complexities, if you will. So, for instance, should we engage with an adversary or somebody that's a threat on the world stage? Our policy, regardless of administrations, has been different when it comes to Iran than it is to Syria, than it is to Cuba, than it is to North Korea. If you look at large nation state actors like Russia, it has never been fully consistent, but what we have appreciated is a clear strategy. You know, when Reagan decided to confront Russia, and Russia, a very different animal than North Korea, but it does involve the nuclear question, we understood Reagan's approach. We understood that he was going to build up this massive arsenal, and then in his final years of the presidency, he was going to move to denuclearization and, frankly, a destabilized USSR. Whether you agreed with his strategy or not, and I know some on the left certainly didn't, we understood it. Barack Obama approaching the Iran deal, whether you agreed with it or not, you might say it was a way to put off a nuclear-armed Iran, or you might say it was a pathway to a nuclear-armed Iran. We at least understood the strategy. There was full transparency. That is what is lacking with Donald Trump, from Cuba to Iran to Syria to North Korea. There is no strategy, which is why this gets very dangerous in Trump world.
And it's also just the naked amorality of it. The fact that America does not even pretend to have sort of a moral role in the country. I'm sorry, in the world. And so you have the president looking the other way at what happened with Saudi Arabia, of course, looking the other way with Vladimir Putin, and then, of course, providing such legitimacy to Kim Jong-un. Well, I thought what I always find interesting about Trumpism is not just what Donald Trump does, but what he does to his supporters and how he changes the norms or wrecks the norms of culture. I mean, it was kind of a glorious sight to watch the Trumpist media flip-flop on this issue of appeasement. I mean, you know, 5 minutes ago, they would have been appalled by it. Now they're applauding it. But I think the highlight may have been Tucker Carlson. I don't know if you saw this. Tucker Carlson's endorsement of mass murder. I want to read it. Well, except if you've been paying attention to Tucker Carlson, I guess. But on the other hand, he says, he's talking about Kim. On the other hand, you know, you've got to be honest of what it means to lead a country. It means killing people. Okay, it's just keep that. Leading a country means killing people. Okay, not on the scale the North Koreans do. But a lot of countries commit atrocities, including a number that we're closely allied with. I'm not a relativist or anything, but it's important to be honest about that. And then he goes on, you know, there's a kind of Samantha Power dorm room like, oh, they're so mean, and it's kind of silly and stupid and not helpful. In the end, what matters is what's good for the United States. Now, that's the, he's, I'm not a relativist. I'm not defending any of this. But then he goes on and defends this and adopts this completely morally relativistic position is that, you know, basically we can't really sweat the mass murder because all that really matters is national interest. And it is the rawness of that transactional amorality that's so strikingly Trumpist.
It's perfectly put. And if you're looking for a final reason to stop listening to Tucker Carlson, he gave it to you over the weekend with his coverage of North Korea. And it's sad. And frankly, a lot of these people in the Trumpism cult, if you will, are people, Charlie, you certainly have worked with in the past, and so have I. And the immediate loyalty to anything the president does must be right really requires checking not just your intellectual honesty, but your intellect itself at the door to arrive at that conclusion. One of the social media posts that I found most devastatingly true, a real punch in the gut, was somebody who said, recognize that this is a president who does not like our men and women in uniform who get captured, right? If you get captured, you're not a hero. But he lauds the people who do the capturing. Right? This is a president who suggests Kim Jong-un is something special. They have a special relationship. He's a great man, despite the fact that he kills his own people. And as I said, if somebody were to try to cross the DMZ without his permission, he would shoot them. These are the people he elevates. And the terrible part of this is the way that those within the Republican Party and those who will forever support Trump, to your point, have fully adopted whatever he says as somehow truth. And it's wrong. It's a complete corruption of a party you and I once knew.
All right. I want to talk about the Democratic debates, the direction that the Democrats are taking. And July 4th and Ivanka Trump, who's trending on Twitter today. We'll be back in a minute, but first, let's talk about sleep. Listen to these studies from Harvard and Johns Hopkins. Chronic sleep deprivation has been shown to lead to depression, diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease because, frankly, we all need 8 hours of sleep, right? Right? You know that. You know how cranky you are if you don't get it. You know how lousy your day is if you don't get 8 hours of sleep. But one of sleep's biggest problems, it's temperature. It's tough to get good sleep if you're too hot or too cold. So I want to tell you about the Pod by 8 Sleep. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a high-tech bed designed specifically to help you achieve optimal sleep fitness. It was developed by leading sleep researchers after tracking 43 million hours of sleep. And here's how it works. It combines dynamic temperature regulation and sleep tracking to enhance your rest and recovery. It learns your personal sleep habits and adjusts the temperature automatically. That means if you like the bed cool, like I do, and if your partner likes the bed warm, well, now you can have both at the same time in a crazy comfortable bed. Sleep longer and deeper so you wake up refreshed and ready to take on the world. So to celebrate Independence Day this year, get a free gravity cooling blanket plus free shipping with your Pod purchase. That's a $300 value free. The offer ends next Monday, July 8th. Just visit 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's 8sleep.com/bulwark. Okay, so we could talk about, you know, more about Donald Trump and North Korea, but I have to talk about a couple of other things here, including the fact that if you go on social media today, I think the best material is about Ivanka Trump. So Ivanka Trump, who is the first daughter, you look at the picture of all the heads of state from G20, and there she is front and center. It's like, you know, take your daughter to work day. And you kind of wonder whether all these other guys are looking around going, hey, can I bring my kids next time? I mean, you got kids, right? It's like, you know, so the next time G20, it's like you can have the picture and everybody's kids are going to be there.
Donald Trump has broken the fundamental character of the presidency. And this is just one more example of that. And to your point, if you're on social media, please go check out the memes and the photos. It's worth the laugh of the play that Ivanka Trump is getting as the first daughter. But consider the real world consequences. A president that takes his daughter, who, while she may have other professional credentials, she is not a diplomat. She is not skilled in the ways of international diplomacy. And Jared Kushner, the advisor on all things within the White House, they go to the DMZ with the president, but the president's own national security advisor gets sent to Mongolia.
Yeah.
So when these conversations are being had at the DMZ, it is a joke. It is a joke. And you have to wonder, is it because John Bolton didn't want to be a part of it? Or was John Bolton sent away because Trump truly does not want to try to play major league geopolitics with North Korea? He wants to have a conversation between him, Kim Jong-un, Ivanka, and Jared.
I mean, when I say it's a joke, I mean, literally, wasn't it the joke to say, yeah, that person has been exiled to Mongolia? I mean, it is like almost a cliche. Okay, so how bad is John Bolton's position in the White House? Hey, they're going to exile him to Outer Mongolia at one of the you know peak moments of the American presidency. No. So for listeners who may be living under a rock, when you referred to the viral video, it is a classic moment. I think it's Theresa May, the head of the IMF, the president of France, and they're talking about something important, and Ivanka Trump just comes up, appears, and just starts and makes some vacuous comment, and you can just see from their faces, it's like what, it, you know what?
Right, that's exactly
what are you,
right.
What are you talking? And the French government releases this video, which is very awkward.
The French government was doing a little bit of trolling during the G20. That was, you've got to respect the way they handled it. But also, you know, the official photographs of world leaders to have Ivanka sitting next to President Trump among all the other world leaders, it does diminish the power of the presidency on the world stage, because the president's peers on the world stage, they see what you and I see. And for them, the consequences are much more significant. We can laugh about it, but he's diminished the presidency on the world stage. We know that. We saw that at the G20.
Yeah, you're right. But I have to laugh about it. My favorite Twitter meme is the picture of Yalta, where you have Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin sitting there, and there's Ivanka, and they're photoshopping Ivanka into all of these historic scenes. But you know, I mean, you know, part of it. And again, I'm sorry now, but you know, last week I was almost tempted to take seriously the discussion of the possibility that Donald Trump might add Nikki Haley to the ticket. You know, dump Mike Pence, add Nikki Haley to get suburban women to the ticket. But then, you know, somebody pointed out that's not going to happen, because if she becomes vice president, then that closes the door on the Trump dynasty. And you can see that at least in the back of his mind, or whatever goes on in his mind, the idea of President Ivanka Trump is not as crazy as it sounds like to us. I mean, what else is he doing other than enhancing her? I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into it. So, but speaking of... So July 4th, neither you or I are probably going to be in D.C. on July 4th. But the president, of course, has commandeered the celebrations, his celebration of America. Now we're finding out that he actually wants to, like, use tanks as props for his so he's really going to get his military parade after all, right? I mean, this is Donald Trump. Everything's got to be about Donald Trump, right? I mean, he's got to be the bride at every wedding, the, you know, the corpse at every funeral, and the MC at every patriotic event, and there's nothing anybody can do about it except, okay, here we are, it's another week in Trump world.
Yeah, so look, on a personal level, anybody who's been to the nation's capital on the 4th of July, one of the things you do appreciate is how nonpartisan, apolitical the entire event is. It is a celebration of America. It's the 4th of July. There are not political guests. Even at the traditional Capitol event, it's run by a completely different production company that puts on all the Americana themes that people enjoy regardless of your political walk of life. Now, why is Donald Trump doing this? Two reasons I think are apparent to everybody. One is the narcissism. It has to feed his ego. He has to make everything about Trump, as you said. But politically speaking, this is a president who is going into a reelection in trouble. His polls are down, and as we have seen reporting in the past few weeks, you know, the president has said it's not the polls, it's the ratings. If the president thinks that he can control the TV ratings every day between now and November, that's the only card he knows how to play. And there's some honest debate about how much media should actually cover some of these inconsequential moments of a sitting president, but that's what he's playing towards. He's playing towards the ratings. And I think Donald Trump might find out in November of 20 is, unlike broadcast television, your ratings might be high, but elections come down to where the polls are, and his polls are underwater, and he knows it, and he's in trouble.
He is in trouble. There's no question about it. You have 57% of Americans that say they would absolutely positively never vote for him. He's been trailing some of the Democrats by double digits. But I got to tell you, and you know, you've been watching over the last couple of weeks, there are a number of us who are just, I mean, a little bit concerned that the Democrats are in the process of turning this into 1972. And I got to say, now I want to know where you come down on all this, because, okay, and I want you to look at it through the, I'm going to look at it through the lens of winning Wisconsin. You can look at it through the lens of winning Florida. Yes, I was, the debates last week suggested to me that this party is more concerned about meeting purity tests than it is appealing to that sliver of voters who are going to determine who wins the Electoral College. Agree or disagree?
Well, and that's it. No, you're exactly right. This comes down to the Electoral College. And frankly, this is, Donald Trump knows that. Kellyanne Conway knows that. And there's a pathway for him to be reelected through the Electoral College, even if 57% of the country says they'll never vote for this man. And what Democrats are wrestling with, is this a primary to define the heart and soul of the party? Or is this a primary to produce a candidate that can actually win the Electoral College? And that's not to say they can't have both, but boy, it is a narrow lane if they're going to try to accomplish both, because clearly the heartbeat of the party has moved fairly far left. You know, I found it interesting. John Delaney kind of was spoofed for being the moderate on stage, but he wasn't actually being very moderate. You know, the moment where I thought, wow, this is where the party's really moved, John Delaney was making the defense that their policy on health care should be keep what's working, fix what's broken. Well, Charlie, that has been the post-Obamacare message of the Democrats for the past 5+ years. Keep Obamacare, keep what's working, let's fix what's broken. And frankly, I think it's now where the politics of the country are. Most people support Obamacare. And now there's this push for how much further can we go? And you're seeing that from Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and now Kamala Harris with Medicare for All. Democrats are going to have a hard family conversation on this. This is one of those moments, Charlie. I'm glad I'm not a registered Democrat. This is up to them to figure out.
No, I had the same reaction. I mean, John Delaney is the sort of voice of reason, but he's out there on the fringes, and it is striking how sort of isolated he is, taking a position that would have been mainstream in the party just a couple of years ago. And of course, there was early in the week, I'd written a piece for Politico where I'd listed the 11 reasons, you know, 11 ways that Democrats could guarantee Donald Trump's reelection. And they've added a bunch since then. I mean, they've expanded it. I mean, that moment when they were asked, would you, you know, you're all in favor of government controlled, you know, healthcare. Would you cover illegal immigrants as well? And every hand instantly went up. And Donald Trump instantly tweeted out, race over, because you know how he is going to exploit that. And that's also a rather dramatic move for the Democrats. This group of candidates is not just to the left of the country. They're to the left of their own party, and actually they're to the left of what the left of their own party was standing for up until like yesterday.
Yeah, and obviously it's typical primary politics, right? You often see this, but it does seem in this case, it's getting pretty far out there to the left. I have a curiosity going into this race, actually two competing ones. One, to your point, is if Democrats just play it safe, the numbers are on their side. They should be able to beat Donald Trump if they don't give voters a reason to get pushed back towards Trump, right? That would be the play it safe mode. A lot of Democrats would say, we don't need Republican light. It doesn't work. Here's a question I have for voters that we won't know until next election day. Is ideology even the first thing that voters are going to be voting on, or is that already baked in? And what I mean by that is Trump is going to define every single Democrat as an AOC socialist between now and next November anyway. It doesn't matter where the facts are. That's where the Republican Party is going to paint Democratic candidates. They're all socialists. They're all AOC. Even if it's a John Delaney who says they're not, they're going to say, oh, John Delaney's part of the Socialist Party. So is there a real consequence to them raising their hand saying we'll cover undocumented immigrants, we'll provide health care coverage? Is there a real consequence for saying we want Medicare for all? It seems like it through the traditional lens of politics, but we may be in an election cycle that is past looking at ideology. And the only question on the ballot next November is, are you comfortable with Donald Trump for four more years or not? And
no,
ideology is almost second place.
I think that's exactly the right question to ask there. But, you know, yes, the Republicans will portray absolutely everyone, you know, as being out there on the fringe. But I also sort of remember, and maybe this is a poor analogy, when Democrats tried to portray Ronald Reagan as just, you know, this bizarre, you know, out of touch right winger. And the way he was able to say, well, there you go again. Remember, there you go again. It's as opposed to walking into it and saying, okay, they're going to say these terrible things about us anyway. So, you know what? Let's just embrace it. They say they're going to steal your guns. Let's say we're going to for mandatory buybacks. They say we're for open borders. Let's come out right in favor of decriminalizing illegal immigrants. You know, they say that we want to socialize medicine. Let's say we're going to socialize medicine and ban private insurance. And they say that, you know, they want to run, you know, our lives. Let's bring back, and you probably remember this because I sure do, involuntary forced school busing. And these are the kinds of things where I can imagine people who are absolutely persuadable, totally loathe Donald Trump, hate everything about him, but they're going to go, okay, whether it's going to be, I can't, this is too real world risky for me.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. You know, the interesting thing, you know, another line of attack that you may see coming from the mainstream media as this race goes on is really when you break down some of these policies, getting candidates to commit. You know, how are you going to pay for it? Right now, every Democrat will say, well, you didn't ask that question about the tax bill. Well, yes, we did. We did all ask that about the tax bill first of all. And by the way, that's not an answer just to say, well, what about the Republican tax bill? I find it interesting. You know, if you use Kamala Harris as an example, she's tried to avoid policy a lot, even during the debate. It didn't seem like it, but she told the story about the mom taking her child to the emergency room door, knowing her deductible would be $5,000. She told the story about the migrant family trying to get their daughter to America. She said she would let all the kids out of the cages. But we didn't hear a real articulation of policy at any point. And so then when you get the yes or no questions, we're seeing some vacillation in policy, right? Stick with Kamala Harris. Is she for keeping private insurance or against? She's had several different answers on that. What is the immigration policy? What is your tax policy? On busing, I think she has opened up a can of worms, to your point, Charlie, that the moment she gets a yes or no question like she did from Bloomberg and said, yeah, I'd support bringing back busing, you're getting into some dangerous territory for a lot of voters. A lot of politicians are told, don't commit. My first race, I was told, don't give a yes or no answer on the Simpson-Bowles committee, because once you say yes or no, they get to paint you in a corner on everything that's in there. And I hated that as a candidate, right? I wanted to have a nuanced conversation about deficit reduction and Simpson-Bowles. But I was told, do not say yes or no. It's not your fight. You don't have a vote on it. Try to avoid it. A lot of candidates right now are doing that. And as a result, it creates these moments where they get caught now having to say yes or no on busing. which is not a conversation any of us predicted would happen during the 2020 cycle.
Well, I mean, there's a reason why not a single elected Democrat in America that I know of was calling for returning to, you know, mandatory busing, you know, before all of this, in part because anyone who lived through it knows that it was immensely unsuccessful, but also very, very unpopular. I think I saw that in 1973, there was a Gallup survey showing that less than 10% of voters favored it, including like only 9% of African-American voters, because, and not because it was it's racist, but because the notion of using your children as pawns, going after people's children, taking away that fundamental control of, you know, your their education, was deeply offensive. And the political consequences have been so dramatic for the Democratic Party, driving people away from the party. And so you have this moment where if the party has any interest whatsoever in getting back white voters who used to vote Democrat but have strayed, this is, it's almost if you had a laboratory of the worst possible issue. I don't know how this plays in Florida, but I'm telling you, in Milwaukee, our experience with school busing contributed to the to even worse hyper-segregation, to the big sorting out of the electorate. And, you know, if the fate of Wisconsin's electoral votes are determined by the Wisconsin, by Milwaukee suburbs, you know, Kamala Harris has picked the worst issue.
Well, I would say not just in exclusively white communities. There are African-American communities as well. I live in a community that saw the effects of busing and then for years tried to unwind busing. And the unwinding became a very significant political moment in terms of the tenor of a otherwise diverse community that even today still remains geographically somewhat segregated. I think that the challenge for someone like Kamala Harris, particularly in the Democratic primary, is there, what I have heard from several Democrats. Now, there are those who are cheering her, right? There's no single identity of a Democrat or Republican voter. There are some who are cheering her performance, way to go. You know, you wounded Biden and you showed you could take on Trump. There is also a deep resentment among many saying, how dare you bring race into an issue in the context of Joe Biden, somebody who just 4 years ago we held up as being so qualified to be the nation's vice president. But how dare you inject this debate within our primary, suggesting that any of our candidates on stage somehow fail the test when it comes to issues around race? And this is where this is a Democratic primary, Charlie. This is a debate among Democrats only, and the rest of the world sits and watches as Democrats debate busing. You're not going to see Republicans lean in on this issue. They understand there is nothing good to come out of a busing conversation in 2019. But as a result of what Senator Harris did at the debates, now Democrats have to wrestle with an incredibly controversial issue, both for the white community and the African-American community.
You're making a very, very important point here. I have watched the, and I may be overstating this, okay, but the media gush about Kamala Harris and how, you know, how masterful she was and what a tremendous knockout punch. And you're right, I am picking up some of this, the blowback. But I also think that they're not doing the Democrats any favors by ignoring the potential toxicity of what she's done and of these issues. So, for example, if I was Googling, you know, the whole issue of, you know, the issue of busing, and most of the media is not really focusing on this yet. I mean, it's out there, but by sort of, you know, treating her with kid gloves and this lurch to the left with kid gloves, again, I'm not sure that it's really doing her any favors. And I have to tell you, I'm a total outlier here, because I know that everybody in the world, except I think Jonathan Last agrees with me on this, I didn't think Biden did that badly. I think the fact that he pushed back hard was an indication that he's ready for the fight. But going back to the backlash, remember how she started that attack on him? And she started off with the most barbed arrow, which was, you know, Mr. Vice President, I do not think that you are a racist, but I mean, and I think that's what got him. It's like, whoa, we can talk about the issues, but you're basically throwing it out there, you know, that is it possible that this man who, and look, I am not a Joe Biden fan. I have been ripping Joe Biden for decades now, but to suggest that this guy has not you know, does not have an outstanding record on civil rights is so ludicrous. And to begin her attack on him by saying, well, I'm not saying that you are a racist. Oh, really? I'm not saying that you are a blank.
Charlie, I agree with you. And she's talking about a man who was good enough to be the standard bearer as the vice president on the Democratic ticket. I mean, he spent 8 years where Obama Biden was considered the standard bearer of the Democratic brand. And so it suggests now that though he was qualified to be VP, somehow we have to bring back this issue. This is where I think you see some resentment building. I do think Senator Harris has to be careful now, and she has to be ready, because in the trajectory of how these things go in a primary, welcome to the top tier, Senator Harris. You're now there. And that means you've got to absorb the incoming as well. I was halfway anticipating, and I would say it's a reflection of Joe Biden's campaign not quite being ready for this moment. I was expecting by 6 a.m. the morning after the debate, the Biden camp to have dropped opposition research on Kamala Harris and to bring her into question her record in California. You know, Democrats within their primary, they've got their opposition research on all the other candidates. They had it on Mayor Pete and the police shooting even before this latest incident when he fired the African-American police chief in South Bend. On Kamala Harris, you've heard chatter among Democratic consultants that record as a prosecutor provides a treasure trove of opposition research within a primary. Now that Kamala Harris is in that top tier, whether it's Biden or not, they're going to be coming for her. And to the point of this conversation, based on the tone that was set last Thursday, are Democrats going to give their fellow Democrats any room now, any license, any grace? Or is this a gloves off that you get to take a punch at somebody like Kamala Harris did on Joe Biden? Because if so, it's going to get really messy.
It's going to get really ugly, really fast, and then you really do have them eating their own. And here's the real downside for the early campaign. I mean, it's worth reminding ourselves that we are still mid-year 2019. Do you realize this, David? That 1 year from now we'll still be in the middle of the campaign, which makes me feel tired. No, but I mean, it is so early, and as a result, it has taken the focus off of the political community, off where it ought to be, which is still on the president. And I continue to look at the malpractice of the Democrats in not holding the president's feet to the fire. I'm talking about the congressional Democrats, and you and I have both talked about this. I mean, the Mueller report feels like it was in a different time. And yet none of those issues have been resolved, so that you have the president who disgraces himself on the national stage, who was a week ago credibly accused of rape, who I believe was guilty of criminal obstruction of justice. And yet we're now talking about what Joe Biden said about school busing, what, 40 years ago. And this is a real problem that we have not fully taken on board the reality of the Trump presidency, held him accountable, and instead the Democrats don't seem to be able to help themselves from turning the channel. When you know what this summer should have been? This should have been the summer of impeachment hearings. This should have been the summer of where we were talking about Bob Mueller. We were talking about, you know, one of these witnesses after another, the kind of the hearings that we had during Watergate. The entire summer should have been consumed by the Russia conspiracy, the Mueller report, the president's misconduct, emoluments, all of that. None of that is happening. And instead, we're having this discussion about an issue that you and I thought we would never even talk about again.
That's exactly right. And listen, I know a lot of people are following Nancy Pelosi's strategy religiously. They put their trust in her. They think she's doing the right thing. I think she's doing exactly the wrong thing. To your point, I think we needed to frame this summer, do impeachment, move on to policy, but let's keep the focus on Donald Trump. Because to the earlier conversation we were having about, you know, are the Democrats going too far left or not? I put myself in the room of voters that I don't care what the ideology is of the Democrats. The likelihood is we're going to have some form of split government anyway. And at this point, the most important issue to me is somebody that can speak to the integrity of the Oval Office and can speak to the principles of democratic liberalism. And if that means I have 4 years of somebody I disagree with ideologically, fine. I'd rather have that person than somebody that I believe embarrasses the nation on the world stage every single day. Now, that should be the message of the Democrats, right? Every Democrat on that stage last week could get up and say, our issue is Donald Trump, and here's why I'm the person to beat him, and here's what I stand for. They didn't need to make enemies of each other, but boy, on night two, they made enemies of each other. They could stoke the passions of every Democratic primary voter by speaking about Donald Trump's failings and then speaking to their qualifications. Instead, they spoke to each other's failings, and that's a tough spot to be in going into a general election for whomever wins the Democratic primary.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and again, I want to answer some of the criticism out there that we, and by we, I'm just sort of generically talking about Trump skeptical conservatives, you know, are telling the Democrats to become more like Republicans or, you know, like Republican light. Actually, no, I'm just saying be like Democrats that actually win elections as opposed to Democrats that lose elections. I mean, you know, be like Connor Lamb. Be like the people who win, you know, who are elected. There are ways of talking about every single one of these issues that is palatable, and there are ways of talking about every single one of these issues that is absolutely radioactive. And I saw one of the leading candidates after another basically take the radioactive lane. And it's like, guys, do you understand? You know, you can run on being pro-choice. Without going, you know, to late term abortions, you can talk about immigration without talking about benefits for illegal immigration, or, you know, abolish. Nobody came out in favor of abolishing ICE or with health insurance. I mean, there's one thing you can talk about: gun control without talking about, you know, mandatory buybacks. How's that going to play in Florida?
Right. Well, listen, you're exactly right. Now, Charlie, I will confess to you here on the Bulwark podcast. I watched you and my other contemporaries among the Never Trump movement take the bold approach of exactly everything you just said. And then I saw all the incoming missiles come at you. And I did not weigh in to back you up for a couple of reasons. Yeah. I was enjoying the weekend with my wife, so I didn't want to fight. But I also will tell you, I don't care about ideology from the Democrats. I'm actually in a camp that I really don't care. To me, the problem with Trump is so systemic to the White House, to our national identity on the world stage, and to the corruption of a party I once knew. I would vote for any of the 20 people on the stage, even if they're talking about busing. Now, I disagree with them on a lot of issues, but that's fine. I'll have those ideological differences. I think it's too critical of a moment to get rid of Donald Trump.
No, I completely understand that position, and I really appreciate it. But my concern is that people like us, we are deeply into this. We have paid attention. We have lived through every humiliation. We have lived through every outrage. You know, we've drunk deep of the cup of the awfulness of the Trump administration. But the people who are deciding this election are not us. You know, I mean,
that's
I am
right.
Never, ever, ever going to support Trump. But I am thinking of all of those voters out there that I think are persuadable that on the day before Election Day are going to be inundated on their Facebook pages with the horrible things that various people have said, and we've lost them. I mean, there's no chance. And we, you know, I mean, I still, you know, am still experiencing the shock of America choosing Donald Trump back in 2016. But they did so because the Democrats nominated somebody who was more awful. I mean, absolutely worse than him, or at least in the minds of enough voters to hand him the Electoral College. And that's my concern again, that this will not be a referendum on Donald Trump up or down, which I think would be overwhelming, but it will be a choice. And the Democrats right now are in the process of making that choice much more favorable to Trump than we would like.
Yeah, look, you're making the case you want them to win. And historically, what we saw in 2016 were two candidates with unfavorable ratings that shattered all records of races we've seen in the past, basically, and that included Secretary Clinton. And to your point, the Democrats do themselves a favor nominating somebody that did not suffer the unfavorability rating that Hillary Clinton did. Because, again, to my earlier point, I think Democrats go into this race with every reason why they could win this. And I think Donald Trump has pushed enough voters away. We saw that in November of 2018. He pushed voters away, particularly those critical swing suburban voters that we like to talk about, who voted because they were rejecting kids in cages, rejecting repeal without replace on Obamacare. Trump and the Republicans have pushed those voters away. What Democrats have to do is make sure they don't push them back to Trump. That's their task going into 2020, and I think that's the point you're articulating on social media, despite all the hate coming at you.
Oh, no, no, no.
I feel for you, but I know exactly what you're saying. We all want to get rid of Trump.
I am inured to it. I'm actually used to being I'm used to my advice being ignored. In fact, see, in two election cycles, I managed in 2016 to be completely ignored by Republicans. Right now, I'm managing to be completely ignored by Democrats. So I feel my work here is done. David Jolly, thank you so much for joining me on our lonely little island. on our shrinking little island. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.